Good evening, ahlan wa sahlan, and welcome to Arab Voices on Houston's Pacifica Radio, listener-sponsored, commercial-free KPFT 90.1 FM, with live streaming, podcasting, and online archive of previous shows at both kpft.org and arabvoices.net. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. Today on the show, we will have three segments. We will be speaking with Freedom Flotilla, as we have done over the past 4 or 5 weeks now, to get the latest update on that Freedom Flotilla boats that are currently touring Europe, different ports in Europe, gearing up for its trip, sailing to Gaza to break the siege, the brutal blockade on the Gaza Strip. So we are trying to connect right now to Karen DeVito and John Turnbull. Both of them are in Italy right now, who are on board Freedom Flotilla, to speak with us, to give us the latest update on Freedom Flotilla. We will also be speaking with Alex McDonald, a local Houstonian who just came back to Houston from Europe, as a matter of fact, where he participated in Freedom Flotilla there. He's been there for about a month. He also visited occupied Palestine last year, so we are looking forward to speaking with him about his experiences, both with Freedom Flotilla in Europe and also his visit to occupied Palestine. During the third segment, we will be speaking live with Arsalan Safiullah, staff attorney with the Council on American Islamic Relations Houston, about the Supreme Court's decision to uphold President Trump's Muslim ban. So there is a lot to cover over the next 56 minutes or so. So I'm skipping Arab Voices community calendar. But as always, you can find a comprehensive list of upcoming events in the greater Houston area on our website, and that's arabvoices.net. So we will begin now speaking with Alex McDonald as we continue to try to connect now to Italy to have a live update from Freedom Flotilla. And as I mentioned, Alex McDonald is a local Houstonian. He is no stranger to some of the listeners even out there because he's an activist also. He's been working behind the scenes and sometimes in the front scenes for a while actually now. And what I would like to let you know is he is also an internet marketer right here in Houston and a business consultant. He visited occupied Palestine. He went to the West Bank and Israel last year, 2017, with an interfaith peace group. As a Quaker, the testimonies of peace, integrity, and equality have drawn Alex even more into the Palestinian issue and the need to open up discussions on the topic in our communities. As an American, he is very concerned about the active role his country has in oppressing the Palestinian people and supporting the violation of human rights. Just last month, June 2018, he was part of the ground crew for the 2018 Freedom Flotilla that is currently in Europe. Alex, welcome to Arab Voices.
Thanks, Saeed. It's great to be here with you.
It's good to have you again on the show. We spoke just 2 or 3 weeks ago, very briefly, when you were in France via phone. So we appreciate, again, that conversation to update us on Freedom Flotilla. But I want to go back a little bit and just tell us and our listeners how you, as an American citizen, a local Houstonian, got involved with the Palestinian cause. What attracted you to that?
Well, I think the first part that really got me involved was when, in the early 2000s, when I heard about the wall being built. And something caught me on the radio, and that was that the wall was being built in the West Bank, not on the border. And that surprised me because I had heard and understood that the wall was there to protect Israelis from Palestinians. But then why would the wall be in Palestinian territory? And so I started investigating and I started researching. And the more I dug, the more I found that the messaging that I had understood and the story that I had understood about Israel and Palestine was in fact incorrect. And the more I dug, the more I realized that my country, the United States, is very actively involved. And I think it's appropriate that we're actually talking about this on the 4th of July, because values that I consider very important, freedom, equality, self-determination, and human rights, which I think are cornerstones to what I believe my country stands for, our government policies are doing the exact opposite when it comes to Israel and Palestine. And so, as an American, I think it's my duty to stand up and make my country mean what our values.
And, you know, that's very interesting. You took the initiative, you took the efforts to find out more information. What you used to hear from the so-called mainstream media and what you came across, and you decided on your own to research further, and the truth wasn't that far away, and it became evident and very clear to you what's right and what's wrong. And that's what we're trying to do here at KPFT, at Pacifica Station, unlike the mainstream media out there or the so-called mainstream media, because it's about knowing the truth, about knowing the real facts on the ground. When people realize what's happening on the ground, anybody who becomes in contact with true facts, they switch immediately and they know the facts. Like, these are the oppressed. Palestinians are oppressed, are occupied. They are not the occupiers. They are not the terrorists, unlike what is put out there by the media.
Yeah, I totally obviously agree that there's a whole mismessaging and the roles are reversed in many ways. And I would encourage anybody who's listening who is in Houston, one of my co-travelers and I do presentations and show pictures of our trip to Palestine and Israel, and we give you basically a 2-hour version of having been there, and that will really help you understand what's really happening on the ground. And I encourage you to reach out to us, and whether, you know, in your religious organizations and Sunday schools or in schools, we're happy to make presentations to whatever group, because, again, I think it's very important that Americans understand what our country is actually doing.
So why don't we tell us more then about what you have witnessed? We'll come back to the flotilla shortly, because obviously that also prompted you on your ongoing path to finding and participating and being proactive. Back to that trip that you took last year in 2017, May of 2017, going with the Interfaith group. Tell us about that. How did it come about? Where did you all go, visit, see, and your experience, your kind of eyewitness account of what you saw?
So it was a group of about 30 people, and it was, again, it was Interfaith, as you mentioned. There were a couple Muslims. There were 3 Quakers. There were a half dozen Jewish people. And then the rest, I would say, were sort of a mixture of different Christian denominations. And we spent some time in Jerusalem, East Jerusalem mostly, but a little bit in West Jerusalem, and then spent a lot of time in the West Bank, and then went down to Negev, and then Jaffa, Tel Aviv. And so we spent a lot of time. It was a really good trip, and anybody who's interested in making a trip over there, I would highly encourage them to really understand the itinerary, because there are many trips where people don't get to see what's really happening on the ground. And it's important. So, for example, we were able to stay one night in a refugee camp, and we were able to spend one night with a family in Hebron, which is a very racially divided city. I mean, it's true apartheid in terms of the divisions. And so, anyway, I would encourage people to very closely look at whatever trip they're making to make sure that they see those kind of divisions. We also were stayed and met with a community, Bedouins in the desert, where their village had been given destruction orders and demolition. And so, you know, we were able to see those demolition orders and see how they were off the grid, had no utilities, had to rely on solar power, had no water. And again, it's racially based. So anyway, so that was a great trip, and I would encourage anybody who has the opportunity to go to do that. But again, make sure that you have a trip that's not cleansed from seeing what's really happening on the ground.
You know, you mentioned the Bedouins there, and that Israel tries to destroy villages there and so on. Today, you've talked about July 4th. Here, we're celebrating July 4th and freedom and all that stuff. Unfortunately, the people of Palestine, with the United States tax dollars, are not celebrating today. Another dark day, because the ethnic cleansing of Palestine continues. Today, as a matter of fact, today, July 4th, 2018, Israeli occupation forces stormed Jerusalem area. Palestinian community demolished their homes, ordered them out, evicted them, destroyed an entire village of 600 people. This is not in the 10th century. I'm talking about today, July 4th, 2018. Israeli occupation forces stormed, demolished, destroyed a village in occupied Palestine, left 600 people homeless. And today, July 4th, 2018, Israeli committee proposed to build more than 1,000 Jewish colonies, settlements, in occupied East Jerusalem. They confiscate Palestinian land, they demolish homes, they kick the Palestinian out of their homes, and then they announce they are building expansions of the colonies on Palestinian land. That's what Israel is doing with our tax dollars.
Absolutely. And one thing that was very interesting in my research, I was introduced to Hanin Zoabi, who is one of the Palestinian members of the Knesset. And she emphasized how a lot of the attention is obviously on Gaza and the West Bank, but that the real core of the issue is the fundamental racism that's required for the State of Israel to survive. And the way to really see that is within the citizens there, because about 20% of Israeli citizens are Palestinians. And it's interesting to see Bedouin villages, and those often are citizens of Israel, that are also demolished, and that are often also discriminated against. And so it's not just the grabbing the land in the occupied territories. It's also even in Israel proper, so to speak.
Yeah, and by the way, that area that I'm talking about, it's called Khan al-Ahmar. It's a Palestinian Bedouin village in the West Bank that was being demolished by the State of Israel. 35 Palestinian families live there. Over 150 children live there. By the way, last month, about 75 or 76 members of the Congress, U.S. Congress, they actually sent a letter urging the Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu to halt the demolition of this village, as well as others. But of course, Netanyahu and Israel does not give a hoopla to anybody in the entire world. It does not matter. It's a colonial state. It's based on destruction, killing, confiscation, and expansion of Israeli colonies on Palestinian land. When you went to occupied Palestine, you've seen the apartheid wall, you've seen the treatment of Palestinians, you've seen probably the hundreds of military checkpoints and so on. Tell us more about what you have experienced in the Palestinian areas under occupation.
Sure. I just wanted to add one point to what you were just saying, and that is this occupation, the reason that I'm involved, not, as I mentioned earlier, is because of my government's complicity in it, but it's only because of the American public's implicit support that it can go on. And the reason I'm involved and participated, for example, in the flotilla, is because if Americans knew what was really going on, they would be standing up and raising their voices against this oppression. And if that happened, the regime would have to come down. And so I really think it's really imperative and that Americans know that it's really, really important to get actively involved in this cause. It's for our, it's saving our country and our values, as well as the Palestinian people.
Absolutely.
So to go back to your question about what I experienced over there, it was very interesting in terms of feeling racism. And the checkpoints, especially Kalandia checkpoint, was a major one, which is between East Jerusalem, you know, headed towards Ramallah. What was interesting about it, first of all, is it's you're in what feels like a cattle chutes. They're metal gratings that you have to walk through. They're very, very narrow, maybe 2 feet wide. And so you can't slip by anybody. You have to, you're one person right after the next. The turnstile lets about 3 or 4 or 5 people in, and then it locks again, and you're stuck in this chute. And then you go through the metal detector, and there's a soldier behind bulletproof glass asking you to show your identification. Then you go through, you put all your belongings on a belt, kind of like at the airport, and then you go out the other side. But what's systematic about it, or systemic, is that Palestinians have green license plates. Israelis have yellow license plates. And so if you're a Palestinian and you work in Israel, you can't just drive to work. So you have to get to the checkpoint. You then have to go through this inhumane sort of process, treated like cattle, get to the other side. Then you got to figure out transportation to get to work. So, and basically, and there's a long backup. So you're adding hours to your day just for this. What's really, to me amazing in the 21st century is that the Israeli settlers, who also live very, very close in the West Bank to their Palestinian, counterparts, have a totally different way to get into Israel. And it looks more like a toll tag on the tollway, where they don't even have to stop. And they just drive through, and there's a soldier, and they just look in the car, and it's got a yellow plate, and they just drive right through. But of course, the Palestinians can't go there. Nobody with a green plate can go there. So it creates this whole different illusion of totally different worlds. And that's why...
An apartheid regime.
It's a totally apartheid
described
regime.
Described by many as a whole lot worse than South African apartheid regime.
Including Desmond Tutu and other South Africans. But that's why, again, I emphasize, if anybody's going to make a trip there, it's easy to go to Bethlehem, which is in the West Bank, for example. And if you have a tour bus, we'll go through the checkpoint, the Israeli checkpoint, not the Palestinian one. And you'd never see what the Palestinians have to go through.
Interesting. And during your visit, what caught your attention the most? What struck you the most, even despite what you've read before? What preparations you were told, what you're going to face, what you're going to see, what stuck the most in your mind about occupied Palestine?
Well, I'll tell you a story. One of our members of our delegation is an Israeli Jewish young lady who lives in Atlanta. And we were in Hebron. And there the streets are even segregated. And our tour guide was obviously a local Palestinian man. And we had to go from point A to point B. And I, as an American, the soldier blocked the road and said that the Palestinian had to go out on a non-paved rubble path just the other side of a fence to get from point A to point B, but that we as Americans could actually go up the road. And so I realized that I actually had more rights than somebody who was born there, lived there, and the only reason was because he was Palestinian.
Interesting. You know what Alex said? We could spend really a whole lot more time about your experience in Palestine, and I want to do the same. Luckily, you're a local Houstonian here, so I want to stay in touch and bring you back to talk more. But now we want to talk about Freedom Flotilla. You were there with Freedom Flotilla in Europe. You just came back, and we are now able to connect to Italy. As a matter of fact, we are now joined live via Skype, connected to people with Freedom Flotilla in the port of Cagliari, that's the capital city of the Italian island of Sardinia, that is southwest of Italy. And I believe we are now joined live by John Turnbull. John, can you hear us?
Yes, we certainly can. Hello, Saeed. Good evening.
I am glad we're able to connect. We apologize for the earlier difficulties with the technology, but we are now connected live via Skype. I know it is 1:23 a.m. now in Italy, so we are greatly appreciative of your time. John, tell us a little bit about yourself and your participation with Freedom Flotilla.
Well, I'll tell you about myself as well as my wife, Karen's.
And we're glad to be joined with Karen DeVito, also on board Freedom Flotilla. And welcome to the show, Karen.
Thank you. Good to be with you, Saeed.
Absolutely.
Well, it's very easy to tell stories about a sailing trip that started in the Baltic and has now taken us just to Sardinia. There are lots of instances we could relate, and we can tell you about good sailing days and bad, and what it's like to live on a boat. And of course, we're happy to do that. However, we also want to talk about where it is we're going and why.
Yes, please.
As you know, in late July, we'll set off from Palermo on the island of Sicily. And we'll take a course that is very nearly a straight line right across the Mediterranean eastward to the very end. And in doing that, of course, we'll pass by Crete and proceed on toward what used to be one of the busiest, most important ports on the Mediterranean, that is the port of Gaza, which is now and has been for the last 12 years completely denied to international traffic. And it's worth pointing out that here in Sardinia, in the port of Cagliari, we're surrounded, of course, on the seaport by large ocean-going freighters taking oil and minerals and other resources and shipping boxes of goods back and forth. It's worth pointing out that cities like this on the Mediterranean are here because they're transport cities. Their economies live through transportation on the sea. This has denied the people of Gaza, the Palestinians in general.
I'd like to add, too, that in all the seagoing ports we visited through, from Copenhagen, Amsterdam, Brighton in the UK, Gijón, Spain, Lisbon, Portugal, all of these cities are seagoing cities. They are ports where fishing happens. In fact, tonight in Sardinia, we, with the ship's doctor, we ate seafood together. The fishers of Gaza are limited from anywhere from 3 to 6 nautical miles from the shore, and fishing is depleted there. Quite often there is no catch. There simply isn't. When they do fish, they're shot at. They're intercepted by the Israeli Navy. Boats are sunk. They are forced to swim and be captured by the Israeli Navy. This is something that people in seagoing ports understand very well. And the reception we've had in many of these ports has been astounding to us. What has been happening recently in the news we've read recently in the last month and a half regarding the Great March of Return has been beyond devastating to us. Most of us in our own hometowns and in our own cities work on this issue to educate people about it. Many of the participants have worked on many other causes, from cooking for the homeless in their own city to going to Syria, cooking in camps for refugees. So So we sometimes feel that when we talk about Palestine and Palestinians' human rights in our own towns in North America, that we're speaking into a void. But in these seagoing cities, the response we've had, particularly from politicians, whether they are local or provincial, trade unions, the dock workers union, they are all with us on this project. They understand really well what it means to be blockaded from your own seashore.
Absolutely horrific situation in the Gaza Strip there. A blockade of nearly 2 million Palestinians can do anything pretty much. Now, Karen DeVito, this is not your first time participating in Freedom Flotilla, correct?
No, it is not. I did sail on the Tuckrier, the Canadian boat to Gaza, with David Heap. We sailed the year after the Mavi Marmara incident, where 9 people were killed and over 50 people were shot, mostly by above from commandos coming down from helicopters. We didn't know what to expect. We trained for nonviolence for a week and a half before we tried to sail from Greece, and the 12 who did sail from Turkey understood very well that we needed to be entirely calm about this process and entirely calm when we were boarded. But, you know, even so, a couple of our fellows were tasered. It's a tiny slice of what Palestinians endure every day. John will probably be the captain on the last leg of the trip. Naturally, I worry about him. This is something that every Palestinian in Gaza has to worry about. Will my family member be injured? Will they be shot? The last couple of months, we've seen doctors, medics, women, children, people of all ages, injured, maimed, as they are standing up for their rights. And this is about human rights. Our mission is a human rights mission.
The last child that was killed by the Israeli occupation forces was just a few days ago, Friday, as a matter of fact, June 29th, Yasser Abu Najah. Only 13 years old. 13 years old child, civilians, unarmed, doesn't know anything about military other than the Israeli brutal occupation, shot and murdered by the Israeli snipers while he was inside the Gaza Strip.
Well, you know, half of the population of Gaza are children. And it's not just what happens to them when they go to the seam zone between the fence, which is built on Palestinian, what would be Palestinian territory, by the way, and the 300-meter zone that Israel has deemed as a no-go zone, which is actually the agricultural zone of Gaza. There is the fact that the children, if they should try to go to the beach, if their parents do take them, then they can't swim in the sea because the water is contaminated, because the sewage systems have been bombed. The water systems are contaminated. So this blockade is poisoning 1 million children.
Amazing.
90% of the water is undrinkable. It's contaminated.
Yeah. Now, Karen, will you be going all the way to try to go to Gaza this time also, or only Jean?
I will not be going all the way this time. I will leave the boat in Palermo, essentially. Other people do want to go, and they should go. People will continue to go by flotilla. They will continue to work. They will continue to educate people about the blockade and what it really means to ordinary people like themselves until Palestinians have full human rights and can live and have the capabilities for human flourishing. So John will go. I will remain so that I can assist in what probably will happen, and that is to get him out of prison. Prison is an experience that many Palestinians have experienced.
That's you're talking about Israeli prison. They usually kidnap those peace activists from international waters, and they take them to Israeli occupation jails.
Yes.
Yeah, it's worth pointing out to anybody in your audience who has even a smattering of understanding of international law that the blockade, it's very, very difficult for any lawyer, and in fact it's impossible for most, to consider the blockade to be even a legal military strategy, which itself would be a civilian punishment, a collective punishment. And so what that means legally, what Western governments fail to recognize time and time again, is that this is actually an act of piracy. It takes place on the high sea, which by international agreement is open to anybody, any nation. And so it is piracy. There's no other word for it. And it's this absurd situation where you are dragged into Israel, into a dock in Israel, in a prison, and then accused of entering Israel illegally. It is worse than Kafka.
They kidnap you from international waters and they accuse you of entering Israel illegally.
that's absolutely correct.
Well, Jean, is this their first time you are participating in Freedom Flotilla and going all the way to Gaza?
It's the second time I participated, but as Karen will be doing this time, last time I participated in 2011, I participated as ground crew. So my job was everything from charging cell phones to making sure people got to court on time in Greece. Lots of fun. There will be people doing a similar role on my behalf this time around.
And you're trying to, well, we wish you really a safe trip and trying to really truly break the siege and reach Gaza safely. Now, both of you are, you were with the Canadian boat from last time, correct? And you're both from Canada originally?
Yes, we both worked for the Canadian boat to Gaza. I was born in the United States, but I have lived all my adult life in Canada. But I would say that in my youth, I was too young to be a freedom rider in the United States. Americans do understand now the civil rights movement and that young people got on buses and went to the South to register voters and to stand with them to support their quest for full human rights. I was too young to be a freedom rider. So now in my I am up in years and I am a freedom sailor. And that is what we are doing. We are sailing to let the Palestinian people know that they are not alone and that the world has not forgotten, and that we will continue to work until they have human rights. It is to give them hope. It's to give them hope. And they don't want charity. They don't want food. They don't want food aid. They want to be able to flourish as human beings. And this is what we hope to achieve for them.
So obviously you're all hoping for the best to bring this attention to this disastrous situation in the occupied Gaza Strip. Hoping for the best, but still preparing for the worst, because that's what Israel has taught us, that it is nothing but a brutal, bloody military occupation that is willing to kill and assassinate peace activists, even, who are trying to just bring attention to what's happening in occupied Palestine. An absolutely noble and courageous moves on your part, no doubt. Jean, let me ask... Yeah, go ahead.
The noble and courageous people are the people of Palestine who have stood up in solidarity with steadfastness and samud and have asked for their rights and have continued all these years. Sometimes people say, well, what do you think about Syria? Why don't you go to Syria? Well, some of our colleagues have done exactly that and have gone to the refugee camps and have cooked for the refugees in Syria. Let's be clear about this. Many of those refugees are the refugees of 1948 from Palestine. They are refugees from the 1967 wars and on, and they are the children and grandchildren of Palestinian refugees. So this problem has spread.
Yeah. Jean, let me ask you, what is the next now for the flotilla, for the boats? So they have been touring Europe for several weeks now, going to different ports. You're all now in Italy. What is the next stop, and when do you all start sailing directly going to Gaza?
Well, the next stop for our particular boat, which is the sailing boat called Freedom, is Napoli. The motor boat called Alauda, the return, is currently, I believe, on its way to Napoli, may have already arrived there. So from the political work that we're going to be doing in Napoli, we'll then continue to Palermo a couple of days later. Palermo would be our longest stop because it's a preparation stop. It's selection of the final crew, nonviolence training, final preparation of the boat, and then setting off from Palermo toward Gaza, I believe on July 20th or 21st, although that date could change by a day or two, given the circumstances of being a sailboat.
Very well. Well, we'll continue here at this program, Arab Voices, to follow Freedom Flotilla and have continue our weekly updates from different people participating with Freedom Flotilla. I am so grateful for your time, Karen DeVito and John Turnbull, both of them with Freedom Flotilla, speaking with us live from Italy. It is almost 1:40 a.m. in Italy right now, Thursday morning. So we are so grateful for your time, Karen and John. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Saeed. We're
absolutely
very, very happy to do it.
Thanks. We appreciate it very much, and we wish you a safe endeavor with all what you do.
Thank you, and good night.
Thanks. Bye-bye. So that was our weekly update from Freedom Flotilla. We will continue to do the same next week and the week after and so on. Hopefully we'll connect with them even live when they reach Gaza safely. And right before that, we were speaking with Alex MacDonald, a local Houstonian who just came back. He participated in Freedom Flotilla. We started talking about his trip to Palestine and so on. So, Alex, I would like to invite you again to talk in more depth with a whole lot more time about your trip to Palestine and what you witnessed there, and also talk about Freedom Flotilla because you just came back and you spent several weeks there helping and volunteering with Freedom Flotilla on the ground in Europe. So we are very grateful for your time also earlier today.
Thanks, Saeed. It was great to be here with you.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. We are going to take a very short break now. And when we come back, we still have a third segment. And that will be speaking live with Arsalan Safiullah, staff attorney with the Council on American Islamic Relations, Houston. We will be speaking with him about the Supreme Court's decision in the United States to uphold President Trump's Muslim ban. We'll be right back.
One sleepless night, my window broke. My olive tree went up in smoke. I heard the children scream. I heard the war drum beat. Gunpowder in the air. Dead bodies on the street. Palestine, Palestine, Palestine. Their flag in blue and white, erected walls in broad daylight. They walked with tanks, they spoke with guns, they thought they were God's chosen ones. They didn't know inside me is a soul that never gives up. Resistance is my key to a door locked up. Song, Palestine is where I belong. Palestine, 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 oh my home, Palestine.
Welcome back to Arab Voices on Houston's Pacifica Radio, listener-sponsored, commercial-free KPFT 90.1 FM, with live streaming, podcasting, and online archive of previous shows at both kpft.org and arabvoices.net. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of the show. This program is also syndicated on WHYR 96.9 FM in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Joining us now live in the studios of KPFT right here in Houston is Arsalan Safiullah. He is staff attorney at the Council on American Islamic Relations, CARE Houston. Arsalan, welcome back to Arab Voices.
Well, thanks a lot for having me on.
It's good to have you again on the show. We want to talk about President Trump's Muslim ban and the Supreme Court's decision last week to uphold the Muslim ban. If you could take us a little bit back to update our listeners and remind them of what is Trump's Muslim ban.
So what happened, if you guys remember, initially there was a ban in January of 2017 where he selected certain countries. They all happened to be countries with majority Muslims, and he banned immigration from those countries. And so that's when, if you remember, when you had people at the airport, there was a lot of protests. So that was, I guess, the first Muslim ban. Now, that actually had an exception that would have applied to Christians from those countries to come here. So that's why it was called the Muslim ban, because it seemed very explicitly that he was targeting Muslims.
And then there was a Muslim ban, then there was Muslim ban 2.0, and then there is Muslim ban 3.0.
Yeah, so 2.0 was similar. Now, he got rid of some of those things that they found problematic, like the exception for religious minorities. But again, that got blocked. And so 3.0 is what the Supreme Court dealt with. It was more of a procedural ban. It was more cleaned up. It was more complex to basically not seem it like he's trying to ban Muslims.
Several people out there, they say that this is not a Muslim ban, and why are we making this big fuss about it? Because there are even two other countries on it that are not Muslims, North Korea and Venezuela. What do you say to that?
Well, so that's very interesting. So North Korea, there's not much immigration here from there. Okay, so there's a lot of immigration from South Korea, but none from the North. So that seems a bit of a red herring. He just kind of put that on the list. And specifically in the case of Venezuela, what it does actually is it only bans certain folks who are part of the elites who are in charge of actually deciding who gets to come into Venezuela. So it bans them and their families. So a very small set of people. You know, think of people that work in certain parts of immigration. And that's it.
Now, there has been an argument out there that this ban is a Muslim ban simply because President Trump has been calling it as such even before he became president. As a matter of fact, many, many times, he has called this a Muslim ban, and he's going to ban Muslims, and that Muslims hate us, period.
Well, that's correct. That's what the dissent did. So if you look at the opinion, it was 5-4, so it was close, and they kind of, I guess, split on philosophical lines. But if you look at the dissent, they say the exact same thing. They say you have to look at the statements he made as well. He wanted a Muslim ban. A reasonable person would think this is a Muslim ban. And that's what we're saying as well. And now, in this case, we're actually taking Trump to his word. You know, many times people like to say, well, Trump is saying this incorrectly or that. In this, we're actually believing what he's saying. We actually believe it is a Muslim ban. We're actually following what the president has said.
So why don't we refresh our listeners' minds what Trump was saying and his colleagues were saying before he became president of the United States. These are sound bites put together by MPAC, the Muslim Public Affairs Council. And it's, again, sound bites of how Trump repeatedly, during his running for the presidency, he was talking about the Muslim ban and even Giuliani, what he was saying, what Trump asked him to do to, it's a Muslim ban, but make it look like something else, basically. This is about 70 seconds or 80 seconds. Let's take a listen.
Donald J. Trump is calling for a total and complete shutdown of Muslims entering the United States.
It's a temporary ban until we come down with the answer
right,
as to what's
really
happening with the Muslim population.
With millions.
And we'll look at the Muslim ban.
The Muslim ban.
When he first announced it, he said Muslim ban. He called me up, he said, show me the right way to do it legally.
And a majority of Americans reject this proposal to ban Muslims from entering the U.S. This is a poll of the American people.
I didn't do it for polls, so I don't even care what the polls say. You support, you know, the banning of Muslims. The Muslims have to help us figure out. There's tremendous hatred there. I think banning until we figure out what's going on is an important thing. I think we have to look at the mosques. I think we have to be extremely careful.
But when would Muslims be allowed back in?
When people can be properly vetted.
Donald Trump's proposal to ban Muslims from entering the United States temporarily. Any chance that Donald Trump will move off that position?
No, not at all. We still have a problem. He has not backpedaled on his Muslim ban.
As it relates to persecuted Christians, do you see them as kind of a priority here?
Yes, they've been horribly treated.
Why are Christian refugees more worthy of admission to the United States than Muslims or even Jewish refugees?
Well, they are a minority being persecuted, not able to practice their religion, in some cases under threat. And so it's just a fact.
Well, there it is, from their mouths directly. Giuliani said, Trump told them, Muslim ban, but show me the right way to do it legally.
Yeah, and that's kind of unfortunate that the Supreme Court, so they basically did not look at the First Amendment issue at all. That's something that we've been saying, right? And I mean, many different groups and attorneys have been saying that look at what he actually said, address it. And they kind of just said, you know, it's not the court's policy to address what was said. But if you look at the dissent, they directly went after what Trump had said.
So the Supreme Court basically ignored and didn't take into account any of these statements made by Trump and his allies before he became president?
Well, they basically said, so here's a quote, the issues before us are not whether to denounce the statements. So that's what they said. I mean, it's dealt with, but not in a very, you know, explicit way. They've basically just said, we're not going to deal with this issue. We'll look at this document as is, you know, the four corners of it. And they basically, so the debate just went around whether he has the authority to do this, right? So they were basically saying, well, look, if Clinton had passed this, if Bush had passed this, it would have been fine, right? So, but we're saying, and they're saying Trump has to be treated in the same way. That's what the Supreme Court said. But we're saying if Bush had said the same thing, if Clinton has said the same thing, we believe we'd still be saying that is against the First Amendment and therefore against the law.
So whom does it impact precisely? Of course, we talked about the countries which are Iran, a Muslim country, not Arab country, by the way, but it's a Muslim country, Iran, Libya, an Arab Muslim majority country, Somalia, an Arab Muslim majority country, Syria, an Arab Muslim majority country, Yemen, an Arab Muslim majority country, and of course, we already mentioned North Korea and Venezuela. But whom does it impact from those countries?
So it impacts obviously a lot of folks. So let's say if you talked about Somalia, right? It's all immigrant visas are suspended. Okay, so there's no immigration from there anymore.
Student visa or anything like that?
No. So cannot. I guess they can have like student visa, but any kind of immigrant visa would be suspended.
Okay.
But so non-immigrant visas in the case of Somalia would be permitted. I mean, one thing that they did that was smart, at least on Trump's side, I could say, is they made this one more complex, right? So each country has its own standard. Right, they have certain visas that are allowed and some are not. So, for example, you mentioned like the Iranians, right? They said so all immigrant and non-immigrant visas are suspended, and then they have an exception for students. So the F visa, the J visa, and the M visa, right? So, for example, in the case of Libya, right, it says all immigrant and non-immigrant visas are suspended, including B1 and B2, right? And so you see how it's kind of they're trying to make it look like it's clean, like it's more complex. So a lot more words trying to, I guess, clean it from the initial statements that he'd made. So just to give you a real example, I got a call from a guy, and he's Libyan, and he said, look, I got married, and I applied for her. So he got so confused by this ruling, and he said, well, is it finished now? And he meant his relationship. You know, he has an engagement, and he doesn't know if she can actually come here.
So this is obviously affecting also not just Muslims who are trying to come to the United States from those countries. It has effect on Muslims in the United States.
Well, of course. So that's what we're saying, right? So we're looking at the rights of the Muslims here. And that's, if you look at the actual Supreme Court arguments, that's what the side of the plaintiff, the ones against Trump, tried to say, right? They said, look, the people affected by this are not just people in like overseas, but even people here, right? So someone who has a family who can visit, right? Or like the guy who got married. Now, there is a waiver program that his wife might be able to come, or sorry, his fiance might be able to come here. So that's something to apply for, but that's something we haven't had much experience with, and we're not sure how they're going to treat that. They might reject folks who are applying on this waiver program, but there is something in place from these banned places that people can fill out and perhaps come here, but we're not sure how it'll be actually implemented.
And you know, I was reading an article published recently that talks about that this upholding the Muslim ban, that the Supreme Court basically ignored international law, and they cite in it that the travel ban violates two treaties to which the United States is a party. First, the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, and the second one is the International Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Racial Discrimination. But we have seen lately that the United States is not caring about any international laws or international treaties. As a matter of fact, it has been withdrawing itself and disconnecting itself from various United Nations and other organizations worldwide.
Well, yeah, I mean, that seems like what Trump's trying to do. He's also changed the Republican party the way from it looks like. I mean, it's more of becoming a more of a nationalist, kind of a closed-off party. They seem they want to retreat back from the world. I mean, I don't think there's much respect in some folks in his administration for international law. However, this is going to the U.S. Supreme Court. They give a lot of deference to what the president does. I mean, they don't get involved much in, you know, foreign policy, as you can imagine.
But the Trump administration, we have seen during the campaigns for the presidency, the rhetoric against Muslims in the United States has been very high. That has caused hate crimes to increase, bigotry against Muslims in the United States, their hegemony on immigration, not just the Muslim ban, but what we are seeing at the borders, separating families, imprisoning them, taking children away from their families. It is just unbelievable.
Well, so that's what, if you read the actual dissenting opinion, there's a part in there where Sotomayor cites a previous case saying that once you discriminate on something like this, it doesn't just affect those who are being targeted. It also changes the perception of a people. I mean, you can imagine like splitting kids away at the border, putting them in cages. You know, I mean, if you're fine with that, you've almost dehumanized these people to a lower standard. And so that's something we want people to think about, that it's not just a simple change, it's a very holistic change that happens in how we are actually perceived as a community in the United States.
So what can the community, and I'm not talking about the Muslim community, really the greater community, the entire Houston area, everybody in the United States, what can people do to counter this? I mean, it's obviously a decision, a Supreme Court ruled for it, but what can people do to counter this?
Well, look, so two parts to that. So the first part is this, that if you looked at the children at the border, right, there wasn't really a judicial solution, right? There was basically what happened is people started to protest, right? There was a lot of news coverage, and that's why it got changed, right? There was no real court. It didn't go up to the Supreme Court. So that's one thing that can happen, right? Like the things that most people have used is mass mobilization, right, protests. There's different avenues. I mean, for us, it would also be to talk to your politicians, whether they're Republicans or Democrats, and just let them know it's not something that you stand for. Now, secondly, one part of this case is going down to the lower court again, right? It's been remanded as well. So that means that it'll go down to the lower court. So there's still some part for the courts to play in this ruling.
And that would be on a state-by-state bases? Or?
Yeah, it'll go back down to a district court. Now, Kennedy had a concurrence where he agreed with Trump, but then he kind of talked about religious animus. You can see he was kind of troubled by supporting Trump in this case. And so basically, there's some people have said that he's actually left a door open for the courts to play a part and find out if Trump was doing discrimination.
Interesting. If anybody is discriminated against here, whether based on immigration or other stuff, I know they can always reach out to you at CARE. Give us that information on the website.
Yeah, so I'll give you my email as well. It's asafiullah@CARE. That's CAIR.com. And our phone number at work is 713-838-2247. And you can give us a call or send me an email. If you even have questions or something, we can talk about that.
Very well. And we have a link to your organization's website also on our website, arabvoices.net. So I only have a few seconds left to thank our guest, Arsalan Safiullah, staff attorney at the Council on American Islamic Relations, CARE Houston. Thank you, Arsalan, so much. We greatly appreciate your time.
Thank you so much.
Absolutely. And that does it for the show today. Thanks for listening, and many thanks to Bob and Bobby for their assistance tonight. People of Earth is coming up next. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. Until we meet next week, peace on Earth.
ADAPT is a national grassroots organization that supports people with disabilities in their quest to live in their communities, not institutions. Each local ADAPT group develops its own style and selects its own actions. National networking provides information and strategies. A Houston ADAPT group is now organizing. If you're interested in peaceful protests, community outreach, and accessibility research and intervention, call 979-308-6407 to learn more. That number is 979-308-6407 to join the Houston chapter of ADAPT and advocate for the civil rights of people with disabilities. All ADAPT actions are nonviolent.
If you've heard a KPFT pledge drive before, you've probably heard this line 1,000 times.
Our volunteers are here to take your call.
But volunteering at KPFT is more than pledge drives. It's the folks who help pack your thank you gifts.
Or the people who spend a Saturday painting walls or helping at a booth or even distributing KPFT flyers around town.
You may hear a lot about volunteers during our pledge drives, but helping out at KPFT is an around-the-clock endeavor.
Why wait for a pledge drive when you can volunteer today?
Call 713-526-4000 to learn more about volunteering at KPFT or visit kpft.org to download a volunteer application to indicate your interest.
Talk with one of our great staffers to find out how you can help.
Again,